Today I want to introduce myself to you. I want to share essentially where I'm coming from. I want to give you an idea what people and experiences shaped and influenced my life so that you can weigh and evaluate and better understand what I'm saying, what I'm trying to say. I've narrowed my list down to 15, but it could be many more or fewer. As I go through them, think about what your sources are, what are the touchstones of your life. And we, it was noted, there's a talk back afterwards, after get some coffee, come back in. We can dialogue about that or last week's sermon too. But anyway, touchstone number one, geography. I was born in the Midwest. I was born on June 9th, 1950, a beautiful day, according to my mother. Throughout my life, June 9th has always been a beautiful day. Late spring, balmy, warm, and with still lengthening daylight. Where I was born, I feel, was important. 2003 Chestnut Hills Drive, Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Chestnut Hills Drive is right along the edge of the Great Plains, demarcating the exact, precise boundary between the Allegheny Plateau to the east and to the west, 1,000 miles of prairie. The late Vine Deloria, Jr., author of about a dozen books, including Custer Died for Your Sins and God is Red, held that people, all of us, are manifestations of the earth. Our hymn number 303, written by the great and beautifully poetic humanist Unitarian Kenneth Patton, articulates the same idea when it sings out, "We are the earth, upright and proud." Deloria went on to propose that people's dreams, their spirit, their whole way of connecting to life are all intimately connected to the land out of which they came and in which they grew up. I think that's very true for me, and where I came from is right on the line between east and west, looking west. So my first source is geography, and my second is family. I was a third child, two older sisters, and later a younger brother, but then they say third children are tag-alongs. It's kind of true. I had two grandmothers, Grandma, we called her, my paternal grandmother, and she was an MD, Johns Hopkins graduate, Phi Beta Kappa, and she had great pretensions of our family's aristocratic importance in the American Revolution, and talked about Stephen Hempstead, Stephen Hempstead was a minor revolutionary hero, and but the important thing was she instilled in me a sense of history. She inspired my love for history and the importance of roots and knowing and caring about where you came from and from whom you were connected that way. Now, my maternal grandmother, Irish working class background, she couldn't care less about any of that. She said it only matters what you make with your life and what you do right now and here. My mother had a sister, Aunt Fran, and Uncle Hal she married, and she got up and out of Cleveland, actually, and was a great inspiration. She got a doctorate at University of California, and they were offbeat and psychoanalysts, and they lived with a house with a view of the Golden Gate Bridge, and she was cool, as far as I was concerned. And like I said, I had two older sisters and a younger brother, and we remained close and in touch. Now, memories of my mom, what I most remember from very young is her singing as she did housework all the time. She would sing what she called torch songs, you know, My Blue Heaven, Always, The Man I Love, that kind of stuff. And she was trained as a librarian, and so she was a beautiful storyteller with a seamless narrative, and she would have voices unique to each character. later. And so when we were little, you know, A.A. Milne, Wind in the Willows, that kind of thing. And later, stories about zany families coping and having fun. Please Don't Eat the Daisies, Cheaper by the Dozen. And as we got older, more sensitive issues, To Kill a Mockingbird, for instance. I carried this on with my daughter, and I could read to her until she was about 13, and then she was tired of it. But I remember the last book we read like that was A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. My family was demonstrative and playful. My dad would do what he called roughhousing, and we'd play tricks. We had a cabin in Western Pennsylvania, which we called the Fur Piece. And it was here that I got acquainted with my fourth source, nature. Dad built a tree house 24 feet up, and it had a roof, and we could spend the night up there. Long summers, Dad was a professor at Case Western Reserve, and so we got long summers together. Later, we moved in. They had a house that was across the street from a large wooded park where I would play, and alone sometimes. Usually my mom wanted me to always have a buddy, but sometimes I just didn't. I enjoyed many urban civilized things too, pop culture and pop heroes, cowboys, especially when I was young, baseball. Cleveland Indians center fielder Jimmy Pearsall was my favorite player. I still love baseball, but I am consoled and held dear by nature. Another source that I wouldn't have acknowledged at the time was the Unitarian Universalist Church. My parents and the church held liberal social and economic views. They were pro-civil rights, pro-labor. They were United World Federalists. And now, it's interesting. I was in 7th, 8th grade, and my best friend for most of my elementary school was Billy Wallace. And he and I were walking home from school, and we were talking about some ethical thing that he had been talking about in his confirmation class at the Episcopal Church. And I said, as we went along, well, the Christian thing to do, and he interrupted me, and he said, you're not a Christian. That was kind of news to me. I'd always assumed that it was just, it meant religious, you know, grounded in a story about the Spirit. Now, the Shaker Heights Unitarian Church was no typical UU congregation. There were 500 children in the Sunday school. And the music was pretty good, too. The director of music was Robert Shaw of the Robert Shaw Chorale. And so it was really like going to the Cleveland Orchestra every Sunday, and the place was quite packed. I remember my mom, as I said, she had a beautiful voice, and I can still hear her singing For All the Saints, For the Beauty of the Earth, some of the beautiful hymns that we still sing together. Now, my parents' modernist views included respect for the work of Sigmund Freud. My sixth source is the first one that's essentially an idea, and that is unconscious motivation, the idea that people are motivated by passions that are often unknown even to themselves. My dad, for all his charm and accomplishments, suffered from recurrent depressions. When I was 8, he left academia and went into the corporate world. Suddenly, he was away a lot on business. Now, his problems with depression and my simultaneous flirtations with delinquency led my Aunt Fran, the psychoanalyst in Berkeley, to recommend to my mom and dad family therapy. Freud, Virginia Satir, family systems stuff, which was kind of radical for Cleveland, I will say. But I think I benefited from it. Freud gets maligned, but his great insight was that people are motivated by deep unconscious impulses, and that these can be brought to consciousness. People can grow in insight, becoming more revealed to themselves, more self-aware. The strong civil rights emphasis at the Shaker Heights Unitarian Church, plus a variety of personal factors, eventually led my mom in the mid-60s to go back to work as an inner-city librarian. She was one of the few working mothers I knew as a boy. Meanwhile, I became very involved in activities at the local YMCA and later Boy Scouts. Glenn Payne at the Y and Carl Brew, my scoutmaster, were excellent role models and, in their way, excellent surrogate fathers. I became, over the years, quite adept at recognizing and reaching out to people like that. Boy Scouts I loved. Scouts inspired also my social climbing instinct. I made it to Eagle. Also important in who I became were some great teachers. The Cleveland Heights public school system was really fab. Mr. Freed, Mrs. Goodwin, Mr. Olson, Miss Landau, these public school teachers were excellent. They encouraged me to pursue excellence and stimulated my ambition, which suddenly became, you know, partly inheriting my father's social climbing instinct, private school and high achievement, and I got myself into a local prep school. In the summer of 1965, I landed my first job at Beaumont Scout Reservation. Now, this was very important. I mean, work and its disciplines are good for all of us, I think. But I learned a few things, especially that first job. The first thing I learned was the lessons implicit in working for a fool. The director of the camp was a nincompoop, and he taught me a lot about worker solidarity. The staff just compensated and took care of ourselves and the camp. As the youngest member of the staff, I had the lowliest job, which was handing out cupcakes and Twinkies to the campers in the commissary. But Bob Urban, who was the director of the commissary, senior staff, introduced me to something else, folk music. He loved, you know, all the folk music in the mid-60s that was very popular. And in particular, he introduced me to Bob Dylan. So now my eighth source, poetry. The use of imagery to activate the right hemisphere. I had read The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere and that kind of thing in school, but it wasn't until I started listening to Dylan that I began to understand what poetry is actually about, learning to think metaphorically. If you seek understanding, said my seminary teacher Bernie Loomer, forget about the philosophers. Go to the poets. Let me quote from the Unitarian Transcendentalist Walt Whitman, writing in 1855. There was a child went forth every day, and the first object he looked upon, that object he became, and that object became part of him for the day, or a certain part of that day, or for many years, or stretching cycles of years. The early lilacs became part of this child, the grass and white and red morning glories and white and red clover, and the song of the Phoebe bird, and the fish suspending themselves so curiously below there, and the beautiful, curious liquid, and the water plants with their graceful, flat heads, all became part of him. His own parents, he that had fathered him, and she that had conceived him in her womb and birthed him, they gave this child more of themselves than that. They gave him afterwards every day. They became part of him. The family usages, the language, the company, the furniture, the yearning and swelling heart, affection that will not be gainsaid, these became part of that child who went forth every day and who now goes and will always go forth every day. In seminary, I studied the writings of George Herbert Mead, a pioneer social psychologist who taught at the University of Chicago in the early 20th century. Mead writes with great insight about how self-conscious awareness occurs, how objects and people outside of us become incorporated internally, how they become us, as the poet Whitman writes and had written 75 years before George Herbert Mead. We become objects to ourselves too, which can, all too often, lead one to lose touch of his or her still small voice within. Poetry speaks to that inner voice and has a way of drawing it out self-expressively. Now, I had a great high school experience. The mid-60s were in full swing. It was the best time to go to school. There was great music, the British invasion, Motown music. There was a club in Cleveland, which called Leo's Casino, and I saw all the Motown acts, from all those fabulous acts. And Dick Gregory said that Leo's was the most integrated nightclub in America. We didn't think anything of it. It was great shows. There were also dances at the Armory in Boston Mills, out in west of Cleveland in Vermilion, Men Are on the Lake. Great dances, and there were, battles of the bands, and the surfers and the greasers would be muscling each other, but it was fun. I was also active in sports. I was captain of the cross-country team. I was a triple letterer in track, and I had, I guess you would call, I sometimes refer to it, my first theology was kind of a jockstrap theology, and by which I mean, I discovered that if I gave my all, I went to the wall with all my capacity, I could sometimes be met there by something bigger than myself. And athletes talk about being in the zone, and that was my first experience of that kind of thing. But I had an even more profound experience in my youthful enjoyment of theater and being in plays, where not only are you met by something bigger than yourself, others are part of the experience with you. You learn your blocking, you learn your lines, so their memory, now you can have an extraordinary kind of freedom. And it was enchanting and transformational. The greatest of my high school teachers, however, had to be love. Helen Roby, my high school sweetheart, engendered in me, and I think I in her, a breakthrough from isolation. We would have these long phone calls. People didn't have cell phones. You would sit in the hall in my house, everybody walking by, and we would talk on and on, and my father would say, would you get off? But it was also wholesome, really. We were well-scrubbed Midwesterners, after all, and it was just great when we were goody two-shoes almost. Now, I graduated from high school in 1968, and that's number 10. 68 was a very turbulent year. The Tet Offensive, Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy's assassination, the Chicago Convention, the assassination of Fred Hampton. It all radicalized me politically. It was a very disruptive year for me personally, too. My dog died. Helen and I broke up. I graduated from high school. My father's depressions kind of caught up with him, and he committed suicide. And then the next thing, about a month later, I went off to college. And we moved in the midst of all that, too. Now, the late 60s was a great time to go to college. My freshman year, after all that kind of trauma, was problematic, but I soon got squared away. I made good friends. I had fantastic teachers, one of whom, J. Gomer Williams, the head of the religion department, was particularly important because, being the 60s, being college, I and my friends experimented some, not a lot, but some with psychotropic drugs, one of which is my source 11, LSD. Now, about LSD, it was never really part of my lifestyle, but I must tell you, it was part of my life. An important part. The Zen scholar Alan Watts said of his experience, when you get the message, hang up the phone. And that was what happened to me. I mean, Mr. Williams was a godsend because I went to him and said, hey, how do I, hey, listen to this. What do I make of this? And he gave me a framework by which I could integrate these remarkable inner experiences into a deep cultural context and turn me on to William Blake and Meister Eckhart and mostly Carl G. Jung. Jung provided my first flashlight to help me find my way around the labyrinthine mystery of the human psyche, and mine in particular, the image, and that is the image of the collective unconscious, that, which is basically this idea that, you know, we have a personal unconscious, which is replete with memories, kind of repressed of traumas or other experiences. But if you go deeper, it's as though all of us are little islands and we're connected beneath the waters to this deeper thing. And it's not some kind of a mystical Holy Ghost running. You know, it's more, it's that which is we share collectively and of which we're unconscious. We share our bodies. We have the same, people everywhere have the same general physiognomy. And, but we're unconscious of how we digest our food, of a lot of things going on. We're unconscious of our breathing unless we go to yoga and really get into it. So that's what he's onto. And bringing that unconscious to consciousness is very liberating. Now, important as reading Jung was, even more important was my favorite teacher and mentor, John Mattingly. He was a classicist, taught Latin and Greek. He taught an evening seminar on Platonism and Aristotelianism, which absolutely blew my mind. He employed the Socratic method, but with love. He was a true philosopher, always learning. When I say with love, I mean, he would, modest assignments, but he'd say, now you better read them. And if you don't have questions, and bring your questions, but if you don't have questions for me, I'll have questions for you. That you did not want. because it was humiliating, although it wasn't done cruelly. It was to help you recognize that so much of our ideas are just ego prop, and mostly we don't know what's going on. He spoke 6-7 languages and knew several others, and smartest guy I ever met, and he was the first to admit he didn't know. The questions are what's important, he said. You work out the answers in your adulthood. And in the 2 years following graduation, I spent many weekends with Mr. and Mrs. Mattingly. She was equally enlightened, I think, and it was an extraordinary initiation into the life of the mind. And then I left for California and seminary. More good teachers, and one in particular who became a colleague, the Reverend Paul W. Sawyer. Paul and Mr. Mattingly were my two most important mentors, and they, like my other sources, became a part of me. Three more sources. Number 13 would have to be the many special congregants I've known over the years, women and men who taught me how to be a good minister. Yes, I learned a thing or two in seminary, reading theology, church history, and the like. I also learned a lot from my intern supervisor, the Reverend David Rankin at the First Unitarian Church of San Francisco. And I've learned a lot reading Alban Institute books about congregational life. But when it comes to actually practicing parish ministry, by far my best teachers, and there have been many, have been the balanced, caring, hardworking church members over the years who helped me learn this craft. I could name a lot of them, but that would require a sermon series. One particular member of my family deserves a place of her own, my daughter. Meredith, now a psychiatric social worker, 38 years old, and a mother herself. The joys and terrors of parenthood, what can I say? It teaches you a lot about what's important, hanging in there, and what's not, keeping up with the Joneses next door or with their materialistic offspring. Our children see us better and more accurately than almost anyone else. They recognize their parents' gifts and their limitations as well as anyone. They are biologically programmed to love their parents unequivocally if their parents only pay attention. and not too much attention, becoming helicopter moms and dads in the process. Sing to them and read to them like my mother did. Make your home a welcoming place for their friends. One doesn't need a fancy home, just a warm one filled with music and laughter and honest expression of emotion. This isn't to say that discipline or order are not important. They are very important, but never need be harsh, only fair and directed toward keeping one's whole family system on an even keel, and where everyone, kids included, contribute to the greater family good. Mostly, it was my daughter Meredith who taught me all these things. One last source goes without saying, but still, it has to be held up, my dearest friends. At the top of that list is my partner, Carol. Many other friends, too, have been important throughout my life. Indeed, close friends are the most concrete example of grace that I have known. Just as I've learned a lot from love, I've also learned a lot when my heart has been broken, and friends were there to commiserate, to help me through. When I've had struggles at work, when my father died, always friends help me through. Friends to argue with, joust, dialogue, vent in front of, or just go fishing with. Show me your friends, and I'll show you who you are, my grandfather Papa used to say. I've been blessed with good, close friends all my life. These places, these people and events have all contributed to who I have become, who I'm becoming. They are my sources. Indeed, they became a part of me. They are me. Who are you? Asks the caterpillar in Alice in Wonderland, one of my favorite plays, one of my favorite stories. Who are you? Who and what and where are your sources? How did nature, poetry, stories, your families nurture and encourage or thwart and try to prevent the unfoldment of each of your personalities? What other touchstones were there? Are there now? Think about it and let me know. And then, as I learned to do with my mentor, Mr. Mattingly, we can begin to transverse the infinite landscape of our souls together. So may it be. Shalom, amen, and namaste.